Dewey's here at Groundswell this year, the 26th and 27th of June, close to London, UK. Many friends of the podcast will be there. John Kempf, Abby Rose, Benedict Boezel, Henry Dimbleby, Claire Hill, Russ Carrington, Andy Cato, Tim Coates, and many, many more. See you there. A long overdue check-in interview with Ted Kittredge, the founder of the BioNutrient Food Association, where we discuss their involvement in the revolutionary beef study and all the other research they've been doing, and where they've been showing that there's absolutely no connection between popular or starting to become popular labels like local, organic, regenerative, farmers market, etc., etc., and nutrient density. What has shown correlation is soil health and nutrient density. Let that sink in for a bit. All those claims you see out there, all those messages, regen ag, by definition, leads to more nutrient density food, etc. Yes, but only if it leads to healthier soil first. And in some, or actually many cases, it actually doesn't. It doesn't lead to healthier soil, which means it doesn't lead to more nutrients in your food. It all starts with the soil. Plus some very interesting insights in the potential of nutrient density. Most of the crops they researched until now, and by now there are quite a few, scored very, very poor. Actually, the majority scored very poor compared to what they could have scored. The pessimist would say, look at the empty crops we've been eating, depleted of nutrients. But the realist would say, look at the amazing potential. Crops could be, on certain aspects, 10x or 20x more nutrient dense. So let's get to work. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investing in regen ag. That is gumroad.com/investing in regen ag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today with friend of the show, but it's been way too long, actually 3 years, more than 3 years. It was the beginning of 2021 and we're recording this in April 24 and will be out soon as well, with Dan Kittredge, so the founder of the BioNutrient Food Association. You've been here, I think twice before, mentioned many times. I was checking my notes. Anytime we discuss nutrient density, nutrient quality, measurements, meters, and all of that, your name and the episodes come up. And you're organizing something extremely cool in actually exactly a month from now, the State of Nutrient Density, 16 weeks online, so anybody can participate. And so we're going to unpack that. And of course, we're going to discuss the state of nutrient density. So welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me back, Koen. Really happy to be here.
And it's not been that long since we saw each other. That's why probably I'm confused, because we saw each other in Italy actually about a year and a half ago or something. So we hang out a bit, which was great. And so, I mean, the worst question to ask is describe the state of et cetera, since 2021, because that would be way too long. So let's start with why, because you have been doing in-person conferences and online conferences, if I'm not mistaken, also last year. Why another one? What was the reason to put in a lot of work? Because it's 16 speakers, it's every week, it's a hell of a job. Why did you commit yourself to another one of these?
Well, in fact, because I feel like it's been too long since we have had one. We started the organization in 2010, and I think it was in 2011 we had our first conference, which was in person, and did them every year through just before the COVID epidemic. And then in 2021, we did an online conference that was very successful. I think it was people from 46 countries and 48 states or something like that. It was a wonderful global community. We tried going back to doing in person in 2022, but
I remember
effectively the movement had, we used to be a local, regional, Northeast U.S. organization, and sort of it's been spreading and spreading, and now it's much more of a global organization. And so we tried to put together an event in one spot. And most people were like, I want to go, but I'm not going to fly all the way across the world. And it's going to end up costing me $2,000. So, and we've been spending a lot of time and almost all of our money and effort in the last couple of years really trying to define nutrient density in a crop. And so the conferences and the education and the communication with the movement has really been put on the back burner. And we made a strategic decision at the board level in the organization in January to say, let's really get back to our roots, because you can't doing science in a silo, without keeping the community engaged is really, defeating the point. It's got to be much more connected. So really excited to have our next soil and nutrition conference online starting in May. And yeah, like you said, going for 16 weeks and bringing together a lot of the leaders that are stepping up. It's really wonderful now that we've got a word and something of a burgeoning movement and companies and organizations and networks and researchers and a lot of people taking ownership around the space. And really, it's no longer just the BFA, which is, I would say, success. So,
and what can people expect from the conference? What are you specifically trying to cover, let's say, in this edition? Apart from, like, you want to paint the picture of the state, but what are specific ones that I really want to double click on this year as a theme or as a specific topic?
Well, there are a number, like I said, of individual companies and organizations and researchers and certification agencies, et cetera, that are taking serious steps to move this conversation forward. And a lot of that I think most people don't know anything about those things. They don't know about these certification standards that are coming up. They don't know about where these labs are established that can give companies the ability to make claims on PAC. They don't know what the systemic research framework is going on with big global entities. There's a lot of action in the space. And as well, we'll have a decent amount of growers, producers, cutting edge insights. I can spend 20 minutes talking about who each of the speakers are and what the exciting topics are if you want.
I'll put, of course, the link there. But for instance, something that wasn't there a few years ago, maybe that's a good, like the last time you organized, like something that didn't, I'm not saying didn't even exist, but definitely wasn't, let's say, in your ecosystem, in your realm.
What are some examples?
Yeah, some examples of people or even organizations or things that, okay, that's new and we really want this to be on stage and put a spotlight on it, because I know those things. I mean, you, in this case, know these people, yeah. But our audience, our community, and maybe the people, the different people on stage don't even know from each other that they're working on this.
Well, Audacious is an example that I think you had Eric Smith on your podcast.
Yes.
And, the BFA was critically involved in getting that company established and getting their lab built and, I think inspiring the company to be founded in the first place. And we have a really close partnership with them now with the Beef Project and the logistics of digesting the data and, what people can do, companies, between now and when we define nutrient density, there's a big space in the middle, which is, I want to verify that my beef has a better omega-6 omega-3 ratio. Well, how do you do that? There's a company, then there's a way you can do that. And, between now and when we have a certification label, well, what's the non-GMO project doing with their One Health standard, where they're looking at a suite of different management practices? And, we were just talking about the ultra processed food, which I like to say it's not, it's junk, it's not food.
Actually, but I think the Brazilian researchers, shout out to Chris, who's going to be on in the future, but I think they call it food like substance, which is an edible food.
I would call
substance.
A processed product.
Edible food.
I would call it processed product, yeah. Or junk. But anyways, we can have our semantic conversations.
If you haven't read the book, anyone go and read the book, Ultra Processed People. It's highly recommended.
Yeah, but so there's a the non-GMO project has got a certification label that is very well known, and they've been spending years thinking about a not a negative definition, like it doesn't have GMOs, but a positive definition, like it is well grown with integrity with respect to the environment. It is not processed to a certain level. It's processed maybe in ways that indigenous cultures would understand. There's no synthetic materials added. What's coming up on the, you know, in the frame of, is there a label you can start to look for in the supermarket shelf? Or what's PTFI doing with their global collaboration with the American Heart Association and Rockefeller and, you know, and research universities around the planet?
What is PTFI for anybody not?
Periodic Table of Food Initiative, which is a very well-funded, very serious, you know, many-year global endeavor to characterize dark matter in food. You know, before there was a Human Genome Project, which was a massive global endeavor, and the National Microbiome Initiative, which is a massive endeavor. You know, now there is a big, massive endeavor coming together like that. There's this guy, you know, Ken Hamilton, who's a agronomist from Utah, who's been doing brilliant research in fermenting foods, you know, like for animals. So you take your hay and you basically turn it into sauerkraut, and your cows grow way faster and add more pounds per day and faster growth to slaughter and less disease, but also amazing omega-6 omega-3 ratios. But you can do that also for pork and chicken. So, you know, anybody who's ever had an organic pig or organic pork or organic chicken, usually your omega-6 to omega-3 ratios are 15-1 or 30-1, which is really bad according to the American Heart Association and all the science we've got. Like, anything more than 4-1 is considered to be bad. And all grain-fed chicken, organic or not, all grain-fed pork, whether it was out pasturing or not, actually has nutrient levels in it that are quite negative. And so what are some ways we can...
That subtle carefulness, quite... No, okay, let's not say bad, quite negative. Yeah. But it's interesting to see, like, the grain piece here, the grain, how we feed them, even if it's organic, non-organic, of course, there are, but that in itself leads to.
Even if they're
on
pasture, even if they're out running around. Yeah. So there's some brilliant work that's been done. There's agronomists, you got people from Germany and from England and some research.
France, I'm imagining, Bleu Blanqueur.
Yeah. Research from Australia, doing side by side trials with beef that'll verify and overlay beautifully because it's being done with Stefan's lab in Utah. I mean, they're doing side-by-side trials with beef, and we're doing a sort of global survey. So how does that all piece together? I'm really excited about all of the, you know, the allies that are carrying pieces of this broader puzzle that we as an organization can't carry all together, but providing an opportunity for that to be shared. And so the model this year is the speaker presents for an hour, and then the other speakers get to ask that speaker questions for half an hour. So we get the sort of the panel back and forth experience, and then the attendees get to ask questions for half an hour. So really trying to move it from like a one person presenting and everybody sitting and listening to a, you know, one person presenting to the other sort of quote unquote leaders, the sort of the curated community that we've brought together, and having them get to know each other and listen to each other and ask each other questions. And then having the global attendees also have space to engage, you know, and John Kemp will be on and David Knaus and, you know, I mean, just who were the agronomists that are doing the cutting edge work with foliars and
Stefan I saw as well.
Stefan will be on. Yeah.
Tina Owens, yeah. Eric will be there, Smith, Audacious. Yeah.
And we don't have the complete list up on the website yet, but that'll be there shortly, perhaps by the time this is released.
Amazing. And so why do you think, apart from that it's way too late, it should have been earlier and all that, but I'm asking this question, like the investor always asks this question, the investor in me and the investor, like why now? What's the, why is there momentum now? What do you see? Because you've been in this for quite a while. I don't want to say a long time, but you've been trying to define the quality piece.
So almost 20 years.
You've been in this 20 years. And so what do you feel like the last few years, it feels, at least to me, a lot more momentum. And I'm trying to figure out why, for all the obvious reasons that we needed, et cetera. But what do you feel? Why is there momentum now and all these global pieces that are starting to move and puzzle and like fall in place? Do you want to learn how to invest? Or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Well, I think, there's a time and place for all things. And, as the climate irregularities and the human health, issues and everything else become more and more pronounced, that certainly is helping to drive it. I feel like, at least I obviously come from my own personal perspective. I can't see the rest of the world, but from my perspective, the fact that we have been doubling down on the science and proving categorically, we just got our first paper published in Nature Science Communications.
Congrats
on
that, by the way.
That's a reasonably legitimate journal. Showing that handheld, consumer-priced flash of light ray guns, basically, can be used to test nutrient levels. A, that nutrient levels are dramatic, like 4X, 8X, 20X, 40X, B, and those nutrient levels variations connect to soil health, C. The fact that we've done the science, the fact that we've proved it categorically, like it was kind of an idea. I remember 10, 15 years ago, the question was, is organic better? And, is local better? And these are sort of very reductionist, mechanistic definitions. And I think I don't want to sort of toot our own horn too much, but I think what the work we've been doing to sort of tease this out scientifically and have it not just be an argument you have over dinner or whatever, and you can each take your positions and
find your blog posts and
okay, I'm on this team, I'm on that team. Like, okay, actually now we have a foundation of really solid science that verifies these theses. Maybe that's helping.
That helps. Of course. And do you see a lot more scientists getting into? Because I think that was one of the issues or the challenges until now. Like, very few on like the soil sign piece were then looking at the quality of the nutrients, even in like the disconnectment in those the different parts of science was enormous. Now it seems like you mentioned amount of researchers in these 14 minutes of recording. I don't think they were there, or maybe they were very isolated a couple of years ago. Do you see
the interest? Weren't.
They weren't there. Wow.
They weren't. That's what's happened in the past 3 or 4 years is, and I don't know of anybody else around the world that was talking about these things. I think I'm fairly well connected. So it's just one of those things where if an idea has merit, thoughtful people listen to it and contemplate it, and then they begin to see the broader implications, and then they begin to move their lives towards this exciting opportunity. And everybody wants to do something that's meaningful, right? A lot of people want to have some purpose in their life, and if they see a space where they can do something that can be part of a deep solution set, it takes time to raise the money and develop the relationships and establish the institution and build the logistics. So life takes time. It does feel like we're beginning to get a something resembling a global movement.
And I think the whole piece to looking at the outcome is such a fundamental, like, is organic better? And it's a set of practices, and it even it's different in certain countries. And so now, like when you say we published this paper, I will link it below as well. I always point below, but it doesn't mean we're not recording video at all. I'll put it in the show notes below, sorry. Like, what was that focused on? And can you describe that a bit more for the science geeks in the audience?
The first paper published? Yeah. Can I spend a second?
Absolutely.
Talking about the project
that we published. Any direction you want to take. We don't have a script.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so, going back to the beginning of this organization in 2010, our mission was to increasing quality in the food supply. And by quality, we're talking about flavor, aroma, nutritive value, which we think connects to human health and soil health and ecosystem function and farm viability, et cetera. So we spent our first number of years giving courses, conferences, presentations, et cetera, lectures. And as that spread through word of mouth across the US and then into other countries and other continents. we were seeing these principles of working with with nature. Like, I mean, the foundational concept here is that nature figured this thing out. And, you know, I happen to be living at, I mean, not living, but at the moment in a sort of an Amish type community here in Tennessee. And so I have to change my words. I have to say God. In some places you say science, in some places you say nature, in some places you say God. But as far as I'm concerned, they're all basically the same thing. There is an order to the universe that is, and the more you are in harmony with it, the more you manage your ecosystems in harmony with it, the more beneficial, symbiotic, you know, octuple bottom line outcomes occur. And so as it began to occur that we would, you know, seeing these kinds of results globally, you know, the concept was if we can, through thoughtful interactions with the land as producers, not only sequester carbon and improve ecosystem function, but improve farm viability and increase shelf life and flavor and aroma, and we presume human health, then this could be a space around which a very empowering symbiosis could occur. We could bring together the environmental activists and the people concerned about, you know, human health and, you know, underprivileged environments and communities and farm viability and people that are, you know, have issues with pharmaceutical industry or agribusiness, you know, people concerned about consciousness. We think there's a high ground, you know, where this work actually could be very powerfully symbiotic to a broad global movement. And so the question became, how would one take this to the next level? If these principles seem to work, how would you bring it to scale? And the idea was that effectively money is a very powerful force in the world and economic incentive drives a lot of action. So if we can figure out a way to align economic incentive with these other numerous benefits, then we have a structure whereby we could really drive, you know, systemic benefit without having to go through lots of bureaucracy or legislation or things like that. We could really be just driven by that visceral, you know, economic drive, which does seem to be a powerful force. So the question was, how would you do that? And our thought was by giving the purchaser of food the ability to determine the relative quality of the food they're looking at. So if you got three bags of carrots on the shelf, if you knew that one was 80 out of 100, by a comprehensive, honest score, and one was 40 out of 100, and one was 20 out of 100, you likely would buy the 80. And if you did that, then luckily...
Even if it was slightly more expensive, probably for most people, or for a good chunk of people.
But regardless, just being able to know would be helpful.
Might be cheaper, actually, yeah.
And I would tell you, as a farmer who started doing all this because I'm a farmer, and I found out, oh my God, I can make a living working less hard, a good living working less hard because I'm working with nature, my experience has been like your cost of production decreases. So you don't actually need to charge a premium if you're working with nature because nature does most of the work. That's how indigenous cultures were able to live peacefully without a lot of work, you know, with lots of music and dancing and lovemaking and things, it seems like, was because they were working in harmony with nature. And we've got this much more colonized mechanistic paradigm, which involves a lot of effort and destruction. So I digress to some degree, but the concept was if we can align this economic, if we can create this economic incentive that could drive this systemic benefit. So how would you create that economic incentive? There's some science involved. You have to define what 80 and 40 and 20 out of 100 are, and you have to develop a capacity to assess that cannot be perverted. You need to verify empirically that those variations are significant and that those variations connect to soil health. So there's a bunch of steps in that process, which we initiated in 2016 conceptually, and we identified three specific, you know, questions that we needed to answer all in the affirmative if this were to be a viable strategy. One was, do nutrients vary dramatically in food? Our hypothesis was yes, but a lot of the researchers we were talking to were saying it's maybe 2%, 5%, but it's probably nominal.
Probably because they didn't know, or we never studied that, or was just not important. I mean, it seems like an important question in general. Does the nutrients variety.
I continue to be flabbergasted by the fact that there's no comprehensive data set that overlays all these things. I mean, if you look deeply into literature, you'll see this person, this researcher found this level of whatever protein and you know, chickpeas, and this researcher found that level. And there's always the, you know, anybody who wants to be a doubting Thomas will say, well, this was done in the 1980s, this was done in 1960s, and this person used this method in that lab. And this,
but still there is, you know, I was still surprised with when we had David and David Montgomery and Anne Bickley, like the amount of research going back 100 plus years around the original, the foundation of the organic movement. Like there is a lot in pieces, but there was in quite pieces. A lot without, and yet there's still this constant conversation of, does quality actually make it, like if most scientists keep saying it's only 2 or 5% difference, well, there is actually deep down, but there is research that shows significant differences. It's interesting how that's just never been really an issue or never even a question that this is an important topic, maybe that you found massive varieties, not just 2-5%, but like 2-5-20x.
Yeah, I mean, and you can look at Lady Eve Balfour and what she was doing in England, which, you know, Anne and David talked about. And there have been pieces here and pieces there, and Weston Price. And I mean, there's lots of literature out there. But as far as like, you know, somebody driving this conversation and not, it's like a dog with a bone. Like, we're going to figure this out. We're going to, you know, take this forward as a movement and put these pieces together, because if it's a biological system, there's many factors. And so you can look at this piece and you can look at that piece and you can look at that piece, but until you can actually look at them all in relation to each other, you can't begin to make that whole claim. I mean,
that was the first question.
When you look into the literature, the pieces are there. So the first question was, how big is variation? What is the scale? And the second question was, you know, what are the causal factors? What connects to that? If variation is significant, does it connect to soil type and variety, like many of the, you know, the sort of land grant researchers were saying, or does it connect more to soil health, as was what we were proposing based on our experiences working with farmers all over the place who are using the same soil, the same varieties, but having better results. and then the third question is it plausible to create handheld meters that non-invasively, you know, with a flash of light can assess nutrient levels in real time? Because that would give us the capacity to ensure that any science we come up with could be kept honest in the market over time. So if we can develop a framework where we don't have bureaucracies, we don't have binaries, you know, my background personally growing up on an organic farm and having my parents work for an organic farming organization and develop some of the first organic standards in the country and, you know, in the US, what would that be? Almost 40 years ago now. I think 38 years ago was when they first wrote their first standards. I've watched that organic standard get watered down and, you know, bastardized, perverted, whatever the polite words or not polite words you want to use for it are. You know, a lot of people buy organic and sure, toxins weren't applied. Doesn't mean toxins aren't present and doesn't mean the crop's more nutritious. But there was an ethos back then, which was like, we're trying to grow better food. And they, as a grassroots movement, started a certification label, but then countervailing forces effectively took it over, at least here in the US. And so can we develop a framework where if we can verify that variation, the capacity to assess it cannot be perverted over time. So that's a long-winded overview of the rationale behind what we did.
And on that last point of the meter, because I bought the first one, and it's actually somewhere here in this house, where are we with the meter? Because I remember seeing you on stage virtually, because I think I saw a YouTube video presenting at Acres or some grass exchange somewhere. And with the idea of the meter, and I think it has captivated a lot of people. Like, can you, even as a consumer, as a citizen in any supermarket, any place, just scan and know? Of course, there's a whole world behind there that you just described that needs to happen first or needs to happen simultaneously to be able to say this is an 80 or an 18 and all of that. But like, just from the practical hardware side of things, where are you with the meter or with meters? What's the latest on that?
Do you mind if I answer that question at the end of this?
Absolutely.
Review of where we've been and where we're at, because I think that'll have the most context. So, like I said, in 2016, we devised this strategy of discernment, and like, if this is a plausible strategy, these three things would have to be answered in the affirmative. So, you know, in 2017, we engineered the first generation meter. That was a consumer-priced handheld, you know, flash of light meter. We built a meter. We were like, okay, and that was a big deal. It was like, wow, we actually have a thing. It's not just a concept anymore. And then in 2018, we built our first lab, and we started testing our first couple of crops. That year, it was just carrots and spinach, and we had people send in samples from across. And this that year, it was only the U.S. From farms and farmers markets and grocery stores and CSA bags. We were not doing a side-by-side randomized replicated trial, like grow this variety in the soil and this same variety in the same soil, just with one thing tweaked. Sort of the normal way agronomic science is done is side-by-side trials, you know, randomized replicated, just change one factor and see what's different. That was not our question. Our question was, how big is the variation? So we wanted samples sent in from everywhere. And so we did that with carrots and spinach that year, and we found, you know, very, very significant variations, 2x, 5x, 10x, 20x, 40x, depending on which nutrients it was. And we're like, okay, it sure looks like something big is going on here. That was 2018. 2019, we set up our second lab at Chico State in California, and we went up to 6 crops that year, and we had people send in not only the crops, but also the soil they grew in, along with answering a big, long series of questions about the management practices. What was the variety? When did you plant? How did you prepare the soil? Did you do cover crop? You know, what was your fertility program, et cetera? So we had management environmental conditions data overlaid against soil data, overlaid against nutrient level data.
To answer that question.
And to begin to build out this data set. And, you know, every time any piece of soil came in or any crop came in, we flashed the light at it first with the meter, and then we ran it through the lab so we could overlay the spectral signature against the nutrient level or the, you know, organic matter or whatever it was, facts. And then in 2020, we set up our third lab in France, and we got up to about 25 crops that year. I think it was a couple hundred farms. And by the end of the 2020 data year, we had enough information to, in 2021, effectively answer our three questions in the affirmative. Across the board, 25 different crops, roots, leaves, fruits, and grains, variation in nutrient levels was somewhere between 2x and 10x on the minerals. So like, this carrot has as much phosphorus as those 8 carrots. This carrot has as much sulfur as those 4 carrots. That would be an 8x or a 4x variation. Like, you have to literally eat 8 of these carrots to get as much phosphorus as if you get one of those carrots. And with polyphenols, antioxidants, 20x, 40x. So you have to eat 40 of these carrots to get as many antioxidants as if you ate one of those carrots. So that's the range we found, and pretty similar across the board, regardless of what the crops were. We looked at organic, certified organic, no-till, regenerative, biodynamic, local, no connection.
I know, like, people were waiting for, like, what's he going to say? No connection whatsoever. Okay. So local, well, and the vast majority, the freshness, interesting. Yeah.
Farmer's market, grocery store, farm stand, garden, no connection.
Wow.
Right. Northeast U.S., Western U.S., South Central, Midwest, no connection. Varieties, Napoli, Bolero, you know, Nantes, no connection.
Sorry, just what crop is that? Just for
that would be carrots. Okay, yeah. But regardless of the crop, okay, like, we can see, Nantes is a variety of carrot. Some people had an overall nutrient levels which was remarkably low in the bottom 20th percentile. Some had the top 20th percentile. So some certified organic was in the bottom 20th percentile. Some was in the top 20th percentile. Some local was in the bottom 20th percentile. Some was in the top 20th percentile. Some, you know, garden, you know, it didn't really matter which of these identifying factors that people are attached to. I'm regenerative. I'm no-till. I use cover crops. I'm, you know, certified organic. I'm local. I'm farmer's market. I'm the Northeast, I'm the Southwest. None of those identifying factors correlated in any meaningful way with nutrient levels. The only thing that we found that correlated with nutrient levels was soil life, level of soil life. So in that first iteration, you know, ending in there 2020, the mode we used to discern that was respiration. So it's not a nuanced microbial assessment. It's just simply level of carbon dioxide being emitted by the soil, the amount of microbes in there breathing. But actually, anybody who knows anything about all this says, like, actually, that makes sense. Level of life in the soil is like, that would make sense that would correlate. And actually, it would make sense that some organic farms, based on their management practices, would have low levels of life in the soil and some would have high. And some people with backyard gardens would have low levels of life in the soil and some would have high, right? It actually technically, like, you can plant the seed in poor soil and it won't grow that well. And you can plant the seed in good soil and it will grow more well. That all kind of makes sense. But it's very difficult for people who are attached to regenerative or are attached to local or attached to cover crops. Because it's not, what do they say? That's not the cow, it's the how. It's about the level of life in the soil that connects to that. So at any rate, we released a meter, a second generation meter in 2021. I think just 300 or 400 were sent out around the world that had some basic calibrations associated with it. So I think for carrots, it was polyphenols. And so if you flocculated carrots, it'll tell you this carrot, the level of polyphenols in this carrot are in the 65th percentile of the range we found. Or if it was zucchini, it was maybe antioxidants. And if you flocculated the zucchini, this is in the 35th percentile of what the variations we found. So we built a meter that is at a consumer price point that is non-invasive, that can give you honest scientific results on nutrient levels in crops. But polyphenols is not nutrient density. Antioxidants is not nutrient density. So, I mean, we showed variation is massive. It does seem to connect to soil health, ecosystem function, and not to label or individual practice or other identifying factor. There is a massive continuum. And one very, very strong, potent fact is, on average, I would say 85% of the sample is below the 50th percentile of what's possible. So in general, I mean, a general fact is that about, regardless of the nutrient, regardless of the crop, about 85% of the sample is below the 50th percentile of what's possible.
So it's not a normal distribution whatsoever. No.
They're bell curves. Yeah. They're bell curves, but the peak is around the 25th percentile.
Wow.
And the top 20th, like between 80 and 100, is maybe 2% of the sample size. So remarkably poor is the nature of the supply chain. The vast majority of the samples are relatively quite low in relation to what they could be. Because we did this survey, because we asked people to send in samples from all over the country, all over multiple countries, different soils, different varieties, different management practices, we had some people who were doing a really good job send in crops. But a lot of people who thought they were doing a good job actually were showing up well below what was possible. And I mean, when I give my courses, I like to start with the fact that the only reason I've come to this point of these realizations is because I started off realizing I was a bad farmer. Like you have to be humble to start with, to be willing to learn. And if you think that you're God's greatest gift because you're using cover crops or because you're using foliar sprays, then you're probably not going to be willing to learn. But if this is what science is for, you know, data, facts, if you're open-minded and you're willing to, like, okay, this is an honest process, then, you know, okay, maybe I have things to learn here. And so, I've been having this experience recently where, you know, a lot of people in the regenerative world are wanting to make claims about the nutritional level of their crops based on the fact that they're using regenerative practices. And
you've been showing that that's not necessarily connected.
And they call us up and say, hey, can we use your data to make claims about us being better? I'm like, well, before you bother working with our labs or sending in any samples, let me tell you what we're likely to find so you don't spend a bunch of money and then find things you don't want to find. And I show them the reports. I show them the graphs. I show them what we found. I'm like, this is what we found. So with that being understood, do you still want to work with us to spend thousands of dollars to test your crops because you think you're going to be able to show you're better? Or are you willing to, you know, engage a conversation which may show that there's a significant opportunity for improvement in what you're doing? I think, you know, there's this big conversation going on around the movements and the regenerative community, at least, about certification versus regeneration. And just because you engage a series of practices does not mean you've regenerated the ecosystem. And so I would say regenerated ecosystems correlate brilliantly with nutrient density, but regenerative certifications do not. And that applies to local and organic and a bunch of this other stuff as well. So
it really is soil health. That's their soil diversity and health in the soil.
Level of life, soil health, whatever soil health is, which we don't actually have a good definition for.
That's your next job. No, but
No. The first job is still to define nutrient density. All we've done so far is define nutrient variation. And this drives to the question of the meter. So if we've shown that variation exists and it's massive and it connects to soil health like we thought it did, and meters can be built to test it, now the question is, what is nutrient density? Because you can't build a meter to test nutrient density until you've defined it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've been working on since 2021 with the beef project. And here in 2024, this is April. I think we will have all of the data from this global project completed completely in our database by a month and a half from now. And now we can actually begin to hand that data over to the scientists to say, okay, now can you give us at least a red, yellow, green about what nutrient density is in beef? And then once we've got that, once we've got biochemical markers which correlate with this complex, holistic definition of nutrient density, then we can hand those biochemical markers over to people who want to engineer meters and they can build nutrient density meters. So that's where
are
it's
you
at.
Saying is
you can't build a meter to test nutrient density until you define it.
You won't be building the next one? Are you saying you won't be building version 3?
I'm totally open to it, but I think from an honest standpoint, as a nonprofit educational organization run by effectively farmers,
you're not a hardware startup.
We may not be the most well positioned in the world to build a piece of kit. I mean, in my vision, endgame looks like one of the cameras in your smartphone, whether it's an Apple smartphone or a Samsung smartphone or a Google smartphone. One of the cameras in your phone is a bionutrient meter. And I don't think we'll ever be able to compete with Apple. And I don't particularly have a desire to. If Apple and Samsung and Google are competing to have the best spectrometers in their phones, and those spectrometers are calibrated to our definition of nutrient density, we win. I don't need to,
You don't need to make it. No. And on the beef side, the beef study you mentioned a couple of times, I don't think it started yet then, or maybe it just did, but let's dive a bit deeper into that. It's such a hot topic in general, beef. And we had Stefan on here a while back. I'm going to say a year plus ago. I can find it. But it was right in the middle still. And I think now you're planning to publish and to have more this year or early next year. So it's coming to, I'm not saying an end, but it's coming to a different phase. What is the beef study? Just for people to understand what it actually entails.
Yeah, but we hadn't even designed it when we last talked. So that was, So once we showed that, like I said, variation exists, connects to soil health, meters can be built, then the foundational question is answered in the affirmative. We think it's possible to disrupt agriculture globally through this nutrient density strategy. And we had to answer that question first before we really dove into the complete process. You know, spend $3 million to see if it's possible before you spend $50 million to get the job done, kind of a thing. And so the beef study, we said, okay, no one's ever defined nutrient density before. This is a really complex project. We don't really know how to do it. We think we've got some ideas. Let's start with a crop that, you know, has some meaningful effect. So cucumbers are nice, but beef, there's basically more land in the world used to produce beef than any other crop. So if you're worried about the ecological implications of agriculture, you know, and economic incentives to shift how that crop is managed, then you'd want to work with one that's got major global impact. And B, there's more money used to purchase beef than any other crop, right? Sugar, rice, milk, whatever. Like so it's the largest global ecological and economic footprint of any crop. So that's why we started with it, not because it was the easiest thing, but because it had the biggest bang for your buck impact.
That's why I do wheat in second, basically. That's the
wheat is coming up next. That's exactly
and
why.
And together, it's very interesting. Yeah,
that's exactly why wheat is our next project. Yes,
I see a trend.
And there's also a bunch of really good companies. You know, in many cases, smaller, you know, family operations, but some a little bit bigger. Doing a good job with beef, wanting to differentiate themselves. So we already have a naturally established set of allies in the corporate space, albeit not all large, who are, you know, we think doing a good job and would want to be part of this process. So anyway, the design was, we wanted to look at many hundreds of different nutrients in the meat. So whereas we were initially looking at just a couple of compounds and a couple of elements in our first 3 or 4 years of work, in this case, we're looking at hundreds. And that's where we brought Stefan in because he was at the cutting edge of that research. We're looking at elements, we're looking at enzymes, we're looking at vitamins, we're looking at amino acids and proteins and fatty acids and lipids and polyphenols and terpenoids. And like, we really want to sort of look at a bunch of different nutrients. So that's one piece. The second piece is the microbiome. So we want to understand many hundreds of different species and multiple kingdoms, archaea and bacteria and levels. And then we're looking – so the farmers
– of the soil or the gut?
The gut. In this case, it would be the animal microbiome, which – we understand correlates with the health of an animal, right? We understand about and stress hormones and you can see the overall well-being and animal welfare and all that kind of stuff. You can look at that. You can have overlaying context. So our thought was, you know, we don't know what nutrient density is. So let's look deeply in the biochemistry and the nutrient levels. Let's look deeply in the microbiome. Let's look deeply in the management practices. Let's look deeply in the forage. And let's look deeply in the soil. And then let's feed that to humans and see what effects we get in humans. So the farmers send in 3 steaks. So we're doing triplicate samples. And each one looking at hundreds of microbes, hundreds of minerals and nutrients in. Then they send in the fecal material. So we're looking at hundreds of species in the fecal material. Then we're sending in the forage. So we assess the forage and look deeply in whether it's a total mixed ration of corn and things, or it's their fodder, whether it's a monoculture or polyculture. Then they send in the soil that fodder grew in. Then they answer a bunch of questions about how those animals were raised, what the variety was, what the age was, you know, the logistics of whether they were living in a feedlot or they were moving every day or that just in one pasture for 3 months, the same pasture. And then a subset of that gets fed to humans. And this is a separate but completely related project Stefan's been doing with some USDA money to, you know, feed this grass-fed beef to humans, feed this corn-fed beef to humans, feed this fake meat to humans. So we've got some, I think it's Impossible Burger in there as well. And then look at the inflammation markers in the blood and the urine an hour after eating it, 3 hours after eating it, 5 hours after eating it, etc. So the idea is nutrient density is the point where all these things connect, right? We don't know what it is. So we're going to, you know, look deeply at nature and see if we can find patterns. And if we can find a pattern, then we'll say that's what it is. Because who are we to say we know what it is? Like, let's let nature be our guide and let the scientific method be our process. So, so we're at the point now with the, we're establishing the Bionutrient Definition Standards Board, BDSB, and bringing in microbiologists and giving them the microbiome data and saying, look at this microbiome data and you tell us which animals you think were most well and least well. And we give the biochemists the, you know, the biochemistry data and say, you tell us which steaks you think were best and worst. And we give the human nutritionists the human data and say, which responses were most beneficial, least beneficial. And then you give the agronomists the, you know, the management data and the soil scientists, the soil data and the, you know, and the idea is bring in those who have specialized insight in each of these realms, ask them independently to
assess,
score these samples one to 100, and then put them all together and see if there's a pattern. If there is a pattern.
And what do you see until now? Do you see patterns? Is this too early?
We haven't done it. Yeah. We're about a month out from having all that raw data to then hand to these people to have them go through this process. And so this is the design and we're almost done. I mean, it's been a really long and expensive and harrowing process. And
any early indications, anything I asked you before as well, a few months ago, and you said diversity is key. You were very diplomatic, but any early like flavors,
right.
Samples?
Yes, there are a number of very, I mean, it's all obvious. The answer is what we thought it would be from what we can tell so far. Obviously we can't say it yet because we're not done, but if you use the omega-6, omega-3 ratio, which is something that a lot of people are aware of,
But still people are surprised, they say, like, Bleu Blanca has been measuring that in France for 30 years and published on it for so many.
Yeah.
I've heard for sure, I think at John Kemp for once and then with you as well, like, people are like, oh, really? And there's a certificate that measures outcome and they look at the 3-6 ratio. And you can say quite a lot, not everything, but you can say quite a few things about animal protein. And people are completely shocked that there's a body of science, mostly in French, unfortunately, but for 30 plus years, like from breast milk to this to that, like it's not
pregnant women, old people, babies,
COVID, everything.
Like what Pierre has done there is, I mean, completely epic. And like you said, because it's not in the English literature, no one knows about it.
In France, yeah. Anyway, they do amazing One Health conference as well. They're an amazing One Health conference. I don't think.
Yeah,
not this year. I haven't seen it yet. But anyway, so going back to a few small snippets you can share, it's obvious, you say, if you look at omega-3-6, that some people have been aware of, at least more than a lot of the other stuff.
If you use omega-3-6 ratio as a presumptive conclusion, if we say that is a thing we think will likely correlate with our conclusions, the answer is the greater the diversity of the species of plants the cow has access to connects directly to the health of the meat. So polyculture pastures are going to cause a better health outcome in the animal, better health outcome in the human than monoculture pastures, which are going to produce better health outcomes than grains.
And just for reference, omega-3-6, why is it important? Because we mentioned it before on the organic egg and grain fat and pigs. But for people in the back of the room that haven't been paying attention, why is omega-3 and 6? Oh, for people that this is completely new, it's like, I've heard omega-3 in fish, I think, but what is omega-6?
Right, exactly. So, you know, there's basic levels and ratios of critical nutrients that correlate with overall health and well-being. And it's the, you know, your cell walls are all made out of lipids, fats. And so, you know, if you need a certain ratio of these different fats for your body to function well, and when that ratio gets out of line, you begin to be dysfunctional. I'm not the best scientist to explain it in detail, but that's for a layperson, effectively what it comes down to. And this is why seed oils are bad for you, you know, like cottonseed oil and corn oil and soybean oil and canola oil.
And we don't get omega-3.
There's too much omega-6.
It's completely out of balance. And
which means you have high levels of inflammation, which means you have the baseline to succumb to chronic disease. And basically all chronic disease, would that be cancer or diabetes or heart disease or osteoporosis or all those things – at their foundation have inflammation, and inflammation, you know, when you have healthy omega-6 omega-3 ratios, your inflammation is dramatically reduced. When you have too much omega-6, you get higher inflammation, which is basically your body saying, I'm trying to process a bunch of things out of my system that I shouldn't have. I'm basically building myself poorly.
And I think Stefan Pierre showed as well, Pierre Wheel of Bleu Blanc-Coeur, is that grain fat, soy fat, protein, animal protein, that balance is completely out of balance away. Too much omega-6, very low omega-3. And they showed with grass fat, et cetera, that the omega-3-6 ratio was much better. And you're now saying that's a good, it's an indication. It's not, of course, this means health and this means science, et cetera. Sorry, I cut you off actually on Stefan. You were going to say something omega-3 and 6.
No. Keep going. Well, but I mean, what Stefan says, you know, if you look, would you rather... Like, imagine, I mean, not, you don't want to imagine you're a cannibal, but like, think about a human who is an athlete, and think about a human who's been eating pizza and beer for 2 years. Like, if you think about a cow that's an athlete, that's out running around, that's healthy, that's jumping, that's bounding and things like that, like, its meat is healthier for you than a cow that's been eating pizza and beer for a year, which is corn fed, right? Like the inflammation markers in the meat, the stress hormones in the meat, these things, it's all, I'm not sure I'm conveying it most eloquently right now, but the effective point is you can see the physiological effects. It beautifully connects to animal health, animal welfare, and the environmental system function. And it's replicated across the kingdoms. So,
and have you been attacked a lot or got a lot of criticism for picking beef as a subject? You say the biggest environmental outcome or the biggest land use is on that, but like, it's a very sensitive topic. The whole meat discussion in general, there are a lot of people saying we should eat drastically less, or even like the world would be better without cows. What has the last years, have you changed any opinions? Have you changed any beliefs, let's say, around animal protein while diving so deep into beef, pasture and all of that?
I can't say if we've changed many opinions. I think to a large degree, we've been focusing on getting the research done, and we haven't been doing much communications. Many communications.
But for you, yourself, like internally, for Dan Kittredge, have you changed like over this research project until now? It's not done, etc. But has your mind shifted? Has any in this super sensitive topic of animal protein? And rightfully so, if you look at the circumstances of most of the meat produced in the world.
Well, one thing I do is I don't eat chicken and pork anymore. And I only eat fish from the ocean. I certainly wouldn't eat farm-raised fish.
Interesting. This might be, and it's not out yet, but when you were out, we're going to do a series on regenerative aquaculture. So we're going to explore the fish farming world and the non-fish farming world into depth. So just a hint that will come at some point to a podcast player near you. Anyway, so that's interesting. So you stopped pork and chicken. Are you eating eggs still?
I am eating eggs. I do eat eggs still. That's what I had for breakfast today was two eggs. So.
While we were recording, people.
I haven't been able to quit that diet. Yeah. They're chickens that are on pasture, but to your point, yes, they are chickens eating grain. And
fermented and grain, it's as we true. Learn now, is that should be, that would be better now.
Yeah. Well, so sprouted. Huh? You want to sprout it for a while. These grains, you know, the grains all have this 8-to-1, 10-to-1, 15-to-1 omega-6, omega-3 ratio in them. So, or 30-to-1, or more. So you want to, omega-6s are much more stable. And so nature will store oils in a stable fashion in seeds in omega-6 form. And then when the grain sprouts, it begins to use that oil and starts to grow. And, you know, depending on which grain it is and what the numbers were to start with at day 5 or at day 8, the omega-6, omega-3 ratio shifts from 8-to-1 to 1-to-1. And so you feed that sprouted grain, which is now a sprout, to a chicken or to a pig, or you even ferment that. And again, you get much better weight gain, healthier animals, better epigenetic effects in the animals, profoundly better nutrient effects in the meat and the eggs. Yeah. I mean, with eggs, you can, I mean, if you shift the chicken's diet in a week, you'll get much better ratios in the eggs. With a chicken, if it takes 8 weeks or 12 weeks to raise a chicken, you know, and it's the meat, you probably have to start at birth. So that's 8 weeks you can transform the diet. If it's a
it's massively
pig
fast.
And that's a,
yeah. The outcome.
All this can be done rapidly. And the fact is, you make better money doing the right thing. Whole grain sprouted costs way less than
chicken feed,
you know, and the amount of grain it takes to then grain crushed and mixed and gone rancid, right? It actually is better economics for the farmer. It actually is better welfare for the animal. It is better nutrition for the human, and it's worse business for agribusiness, right? I mean, there's economic incentives that are have caused us to shift. I mean, 100 years ago, chickens were not eating corn and soy. 100 years ago, pigs were not eating corn and soy. 100 years ago, cows were not eating corn. This is not like the way animals have always eaten. And there is a reason that people, when they eat meat, have negative health outcomes in many cases. But it's not the meat. It's how it's produced. And your soy burger has got all those high levels of omega-6s in it. Right. And your vegetable oils have horrible levels of omega-6s in them. So from a human health nutritional standpoint, you know, there's a lot to say here. And I mean, I didn't even talk about whether there should be cows on the planet. I mean, what was the Serengeti full of? You know, what was the American West full of?
Yeah, but when people nature argue was flourishing, that we have, we've so many. I mean, those numbers are interesting in general. And but there's these are. Yeah, but. Now we put them inside. We have more animals now than we had before. I don't think the numbers should back that up. But there's a very interesting discussion there. But just to, because I want to be conscious of your time as well, and ask a few more questions on the wheat project. So next up is wheat. You haven't...
Yeah.
I mean, what should we be eating wheat in general? I think is the first question. Like, why wheat? Apart from the huge footprint, because that's undeniable.
Well, it's because there's a massive variation in wheat in nutrient levels.
We conquered wheat, or wheat conquered us? But yeah,
the fact is, we eat a lot of grain. You know, whether you're in a wheat based diet or a rice based diet, I mean, grains are a significant portion of the diet of. Industrialized, civilized, quote unquote, you know, people can't see my air quotes in the video because there's no video in the audio because you're not getting it. But, you know, since we started quote unquote agriculture, which is when we stopped doing, you know, systemic, brilliant indigenous permaculture, grains have taken on a much larger portion of our diets because they're stable and they can be stored and you can, you know, have cities and have armies and things when you are eating grains. So we have a lot of grains in our diet and there's a lot of difficulty that people have digesting grains. In some cases they can't eat wheat, et cetera. But if you feed them an old Corazon wheat a lot of the gluten intolerance seems to have started when we hybridized wheat. And, you know, humans were eating wheat for a long time and not experiencing gluten intolerance, but they were also eating sourdough bread. So they were lacto-fermenting. And anybody who's from India who knows anything at all knows you don't just cook the rice. You sprout the rice first. You release the phytase inhibitors. There's all this wisdom, not just about how the food is grown, but then how it's
cooked,
produced.
Processed.
So we were talking about the, you know, ultra processed food. Like, this is the Weston Price work and, you know, all that kind of thing where traditional cultures that seem to have healthy physiological development, they lacto-fermented their food. They lacto-fermented their meat. They lacto-fermented their milk. They lacto-fermented their grain. They lacto-fermented their vegetables. They pre-digested with microbes their food, which is, you know, as I said, one of the presentations that we're going to have for the conference is how you can pre-digest the food for your animals, whether they're cows or chickens or pigs, to get that similar beneficial effect. So, but from a foundational standpoint, there are many different varieties of wheat and they're grown in many different ways. And so begin to tease out what would be the, you know, more optimal biochemical matrix in your grain you're working with and then how to produce it, you know, I think is a piece of this process. What's exciting about taking on wheat and then other subsequent crops is now that we've got this relationship with Audacious. And we've spent 3 years figuring out how to do nutrient density research. We hopefully can do it in, you know, 6 months instead of 3 years, and for a quarter million instead of a million. So we can, now that we've figured out how to define nutrient density, we think we can really speed up the process and do it much more inexpensively so that it becomes plausible, you know, in a couple of years to have 10 or 20 crops defined, so that it becomes plausible to engineer the meters that can be used to bring that insight to the market. So it's a multi-year, you know, systemic process, but I feel like we're making pretty good headway.
And do you think it'll be, it's impossible to, like, the wheat part is so interesting. No, because it's so interesting if we should be eating that at all. I am definitely, but it's such a big part of our culture. It seems even bigger than animal protein. But it's not such a touchy subject until you, it's very interesting what role it plays, breaking bread together, or the rice piece in many cultures, or like, it's such a big thing. And it's very interesting. And it's such a big acreage globally, like the impact in terms of, it's just
massive. Is it white flour? Yeah. Is it whole flour? Right. White rice or brown rice? Is it, you know, are you sprouting the wheat before you grind it and then lacto-ferment it into sourdough bread? Or are you taking white flour and then putting these like totally unnatural, you know, expanding agents into it and causing a, like, you go from flour to bread in 15 minutes, literally, like the whole thing, like they mix it with water. They put this compound in that gets really big. They flash cook it. And it's like white bread is just an atrocious substance. It's not really bread, right? Technically it's not legally bread because it didn't raise with yeast. It wasn't raised with, it didn't expand with, it didn't ferment. And there was no, I mean, yeah, this whole thing of what we call food and the ultra processed product, it really, in many cases, is just not food. I call it junk. Let's call it junk. Let's not beat around the bush here.
Let's not be nice.
You know,
I'm very curious.
Who's that guy you're talking about?
Yeah, Eddie, I'm going to give Eddie a shout out here. Eddie Abu, find him on Instagram. He's definitely not going around the bush there about ultra processed food.
He's not PC.
No, he's this is not something you. I mean, and he just reads out ingredients of. For sure, he was new to me. I saw Henry the movie introduced me to him to the wonderful world of Eddie and real food. And of course, not everything he says is true. And don't start writing emails, people, please. But he's hitting a nerve with people and just very simply showing ingredients and showing what kind of crap is in there. And you shouldn't be putting this in your body. Yes. This is not food. And so the message
definitely is children's is bodies.
Yeah. And children's bodies. Yeah. And in general, and he's an ex bodybuilder. He has been on the steroids and all of that, and knows how important the body is. And he's having a very successful Instagram channel at the moment. This might be over when this goes out. But I don't think so. Because he's hitting a nerve and he's being kicked out of supermarkets for reading out ingredients. So definitely go and check Eddie out. But also go and check Dan out. I'm super interested in what's going to come out. Of course, of the beef piece, but definitely also the wheat piece and the conference that's coming up. So make sure you follow that if you're interested in that topic. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here 1 hour and 5 minutes after we started recording. So I'm imagining you're interested. Go and sign up and follow some of the amazing speakers that Dan has put together. So I want to thank you so much for the work you do, coming back here after 3 years, which is way too long. And of course, for putting together an amazing conference that anybody can follow from anywhere.
And thank you for all the amazing work you've been doing, Koen. It's really wonderful to have known you from right when you got started and to see all the really amazingly positive effect you've been having. So
it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Great appreciation and respect.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.